Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spiriteen Paranormal Universe. This is Doug Kelly, your co-host, along with my friend and co-host, Grant Rubendunst. Welcome, Grant.
Hey, happy Friday night, everybody.
It's good to have everybody on. We, of course, are on our new venue, Blog Talk Radio. We have switched over. This is our first show of doing it through the Blog Talk Radio. Hopefully, it will be a much better forum, a much better venue. For those of you joining us live, all you have to do is click on that listen button, and you'll, if you're registered, I believe you'll need to do that to be able to join the chat room, but give it a shot. I'm still learning a little bit about this myself. You can also call in live and ask questions for this show, for our guest tonight. We'll get to in just a moment. The call-in number is listed there on our site, and it's blogtalkradio.com/spiritteam with one T. That'll get you there. And the call-in number for listeners is area code 347-945-7799, 347-945-7799. We can take your call. You'll hear the music, or rather the show in progress as you're on hold, and then we'll take your call. We encourage you to call if you have questions, and let's talk about our special guest tonight. We have with us Laura Hladek, founder of the New Jersey Ghost Hunters Society. Laura has been ghost hunting since 1993. She founded the New Jersey Ghost Hunter Society back in 98. In addition to hunting in New Jersey, she's ghost hunted in Savannah, Georgia, Francisville, Louisiana, New Orleans, St. Johnsville, looks like a lot of places, Gettysburg, Chicago, Nashville, Memphis, Chattanooga. She conducted the first New Jersey Ghost Conference at the Inn at Five Ponds in Vermont in 99. Her interest in the paranormal started in childhood with her dad introducing her to the Twilight Zone and finishing out eighth grade living in a haunted house. And there's more, but let's welcome Laura. Welcome, Laura.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. You've been doing paranormal research for a long time.
Yeah, pretty much got into it, you know, interested in it, I should say, as a kid, and went away from it for, you know, a period in early adulthood of, you know, the whole marriage, career, mommy track thing, and just got back into it in 93 officially, and by 98, like you were saying, formed the New Jersey Ghost Hunter Society, so been doing a lot.
So what made you get back into it?
I was on a ghost tour, actually, and the Spy House Museum. It was October of 1992. They were having, for Halloween, they were doing these ghost tours there, and my then husband and I went on the tour, and we had a paranormal experience before the tour even started. We were just standing in the one front room waiting for the tour, and then we had an experience during the tour, and after that, we went out for coffee, and we were talking, and he was just like, "Wow, where's all this information coming from?" I'm like, "Oh, I did a paper on it back in high school, but, you know." And he goes, "Well, you never thought to mention this, huh?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, you get busy in life. It's not like, oh, by the way, do you want to go hunt ghosts?" It never comes up in conversation. So, you know, so it was fun. And then we started doing, you know, some different things at the Spy House. They were doing seances there, and we went for a couple of those, and Cool. Started the ghost hunting, and you know, I don't know if people listening are unfamiliar with the Spy House. It's technically the Seabrook Wilson House. It's in Port Monmouth, New Jersey, and it's the supposedly the most haunted place on the Eastern Seaboard, and it's in the top five for the country.
Wow!
Wow! And when you guys did that, Laura, back in those, you know, back in 1993. You probably didn't have a lot in the way of equipment or what you did have. Tell us a little bit about what you guys, how you conducted an investigation when you were first starting out.
Oh, gosh. You know, when we first started out, we had a Pentax 35-millimeter camera. My then-husband, he's a radio technician, two-way radio technician, so he had the professional EMF meter, you know, that he would use to climb up and down towers and stuff. We had that. We had a Sony 8mm camcorder and an Iowa boom box to stand there with a cassette tape for analog to record for EVP. And basically, I had, you know, a ghostometer in my sensitivity. And we'd walk into a room, and he would look at me and say, "What do you get?" And I'd be like, "Take a picture there, and now take one over there." And I was getting, you know, the more that we took pictures that way and the more I got them developed, I could see the correlation between the feeling or the sensation I had and how it was becoming a hit in terms of getting something on film. So I used to call it my ghostometer, and that's basically how we started out. You know, the basic equipment was set up and be filming on a camcorder and taking pictures, but it was like, well, what did you feel here? All right, take a picture. And then once digital came out and you had that instant feedback on the screen on the back of the camera, my ghostometer just went to, you know, by the wayside, because I got so dependent on the digital and looking to see right then and there if I had something. And, you know, so things have changed dramatically.
So I would imagine.
Yeah.
So your ghostometer, can you explain that a little bit? What was that you were using?
That's internal feeling. Everybody has that sixth sense. Mine worked in one of two ways. Sometimes I would get like that butterfly flutter feeling in my stomach, and I would kind of be drawn to where I'll take a picture in this direction. Basements, for some reason, I get head rushes. So for some reason, when I go below the Earth's surface, for whatever reason, if there's any kind of spirit energy, my head kind of gets that lightheaded head rush feeling. And, you know, but over the years, like I said, I've really gotten away from it because I got so dependent on all this this gizmo stuff we have now. I mean, tiny little digital audio recorders for EVP. I mean, picture me lugging a boom box. I mean, I'm talking an Iowa boom box, you know, with an analog tape, you know. And now I have this teeny little thing I take out of its little case, and it hooks up via USB to the computer, and the sound quality is, you know, 100 times better because it's all digital. So
do you consider yourself psychically sensitive, Laura?
Definitely I'm not on par with, like, people who say, oh, I'm a clairvoyant, oh, I'm psychic. I wouldn't claim to be that on my best day. I go by the rule that everybody has this, and depending on, it takes you time to figure out what your sensation is. Some people will feel like their stomach dropping, like they're going down a roller coaster or the elevator dropped out from under them. Some people get the head rush. Other people get like a, you know, that weird, like the hair standing up on the back of their neck or that sensation. And it's different for everybody, but a lot of people are just shut down, you know. And even like myself, I'm not someone like John Edwards that would walk up to you and say, oh, and by the way, your Aunt Sue is here, you know. And so I'm just going by the very innate, basic, you know, sixth sense that I think everybody has anyway.
Yeah, but you must have something because your ghostometer, I mean, you were picking up on some things, right?
Yeah, but that was back then, yeah, because it was basically all we had to really go on. And we started seeing, like I said, the correlation between, you know, what was being developed on film, and I could trace it back. Like, I could look at the picture and say, yes, I had that weird feeling. And it was getting to the point where at one point when the flash would go off, I could actually see the orb for a split second when the flash went off. And I'd be like, ooh, I think that's the shot we got one, because I think I saw it out of the corner of my eye, and sure enough, there it was. And, you know. And I've had it, people say, well, do you ever see orbs with your naked eye? And you can, but it's more your peripheral vision that will see them. The time when I was up at Ohika Castle out in Long Island, and I was sitting there on the couch, and we're having champagne and toasting one another, and I see this orb out of the corner of my eye fly by. And I got up, and I'm maintaining eye contact with him, and I'm like, just keep talking. And I made my way over to my ghost bag, and I took the camera out and fired off a few shots in the direction that I thought I saw it go, and sure enough, that's the, you know, the orb was right above the four-poster bed.
Wow.
How would you kind of contrast, Laura, how photography has changed and from when you were starting off with a 35 millimeter and what we have with digital now, and also just kind of out of curiosity, do you feel that your sensitivity has grown over the years that you've been doing this?
Oh, no, quite the opposite. The sensitivity definitely diminished because I'm so dependent on the looking at the camera and seeing what it's picking up. As far as the cameras go, I mean, back then, like I said, it was a really nice Pentax camera. It was 35 millimeter, and the thing with 35 millimeter versus digital was you had a higher success rate of capturing a paranormal anomaly, supposedly, because with digital. Because the deal with film was when you shot film, if you shot Fuji, you were shooting in the blue and green color spectrum. And if you shot Kodak Gold, which was my favorite, you would be in the reds and golds color spectrum. And digital goes the entire color spectrum, so therefore you kind of doubled your ability to capture something. So I would say, yeah, the digital. And initially when digital came out, I mean, what was the best you could take was 1 meg photo. You know,
yeah.
And all the professional photographers that I dealt with were all like poo-pooing digital. It'll never surpass film. Look at how the brilliance of the colors and the pixelation and the definition and da 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 da. Well, now it's like I have a Nikon. You know, and back then I had that huge Sony Mavica with digital when it came out, and that was its highest setting was 1 meg, but. You know, not for nothing, it took the floppy disks. Remember those little 3.5, 3.25 floppy disks?
Vaguely remember, yeah.
Yes, yes. And that's what I shot all the pictures on. And you know what? But not for nothing, the camera was good. I mean, those pictures were always clear. They were, and even, you know, it's funny because back then, a 1 meg photo would kill somebody on email if you sent it to them, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I used to tell people all the time, you know, lower the setting on your camera if you're going to send me the picture because I was on a dial-up. And now everybody's got broadband. I've got a tiny camera. It's my Nikon now. I have a Nikon Coolpix, so it's probably 1/4 the size of that dinosaur Mavica. And it takes a little, you know, like a little card, you know, goes in the side and holds up to 1 gig card is in the camera, and its highest setting is 8 megapixel, which, you know, at that point, you're doing, like, home, you know, portrait photography at 8 meg, because most photographers now who switched over to digital will shoot at 12 meg for a really, like, if they're going to blow it up to a 16x20 portrait, that's what they tell me, 12 meg is what you would do. If you're going to do an 8x10 portrait, 8 meg is sufficient, and that's what this camera will shoot at.
Mm-hmm.
So it's different. I mean, I've also heard, I was doing a presentation, I think, down in Cape May, and these people came up to me afterwards, and they said, you know, they've been testing the theory of the settings now of the digital cameras, saying, you know, because, you know, you did have this higher success rate with capturing orbs with digital. And, of course, we've since come to realize a lot of the orbs can be discounted as pollen or dust or pet dander, what have you. And, you know, once in a while you do have that significant, genuine, whatever it is, we call it an orb, that little white dot there. Ooh. And these people came up to me and they said, well, they've been testing the theory that it has to do with at what setting you have your camera at. And what they did is they had the one person kept her camera at 2 meg, and the person next to her kept his camera all the way up at 8 meg, throughout their investigation, and they stayed together, and they would take the shots, you know, she would take hers, he would take his, and everywhere where she was picking up an orb, not all the time was the 8-megapixel setting picking it up. And they said, you know, there was maybe one or two pictures that they both got an orb in the same place, and it really looked like the real deal orb, not the dust and the pollen. So they were drawing the conclusion that you should really take whatever digital camera you have and bump it up to at least 8 meg in order to get rid of all those orb shots that you would disqualify anyway.
Well, let me ask you a question, Laura, on that. That's interesting. The two cameras, were they, what kind of, how were they different? Were they the same model? Were they different models?
That I couldn't answer honestly. I'm sure he told me, but I don't honestly recall.
Were they both,
remember them.
Were they both the compact digital type cameras, just the small?
Oh, yeah, they were the hand ones. They weren't like professional, you know, the zoom in up the crack of your butt type of lens camera, you know.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay. Interesting subject there, but and we'll do that one another time. Here's a question, though. When you guys get orbs, what kind of criteria do you use to differentiate between dust, pollen, moisture, and perhaps a spirit orb? Is there any particular thing you do?
Well, the first thing we do is we train people on our protocols, which will save you a lot of grief and aggravation because, you know, you're not going to be shooting and taking pictures outside if it's very humid, if there's snow, if it's raining, anything, any atmospheric condition, foggy, that's going to cause condensation on the lens. And so right there, you wouldn't do it. You know, in a house, you have to understand that there's going to, no matter how clean the house is, there's going to be dust. Usually, our one investigator has one of those high-powered, I don't know if it's like a 1,000-candle-power lamps that he'll bring in and shine. And that will pretty much show you when you scan the room if there's a lot of dust floating in the air. And, you know, then you can kind of judge your photos from that going forward, whether it was dust. And the main thing, too, when you get a picture of dust or pollen, it seems to, especially dust, travels in what I call herds, you know. And you'll get, like, this swirling multitude of orbs showing up. And sometimes people come running up to me at the end of a lecture, and they're like, look at this, look how many ghosts I got. And I'm like, no, you got a lot of dust, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, see that big swirling pattern? You know, ghosts can be creative, I'm sure, like the rest of us, but I don't think they're going to try to make this pattern every time.
Huh.
And then there's different orbs, too. Not beyond the pollen, the dust, and the moisture, there's the infrared orb, and that comes from people using their autofocus cameras. So we always train people to do what we call calling the shot. So if you're going to take the shot, you say, you know, taking a shot or calling the shot, that person's allowed to fire their camera, everybody else waits, and then the next person will call it and take their shot. Because in the time it takes, like if I was standing next to that person and they took their picture right when I was getting ready to take mine, my camera now sends out the infrared beam to focus the camera and bounce it back to the camera. And while they took their picture, they got a picture of my infrared beam, and they get this gigantic transparent orb, and they're like, look at that. And I'm like, no, it's the infrared beam, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Well, let's go back to the beginning. Can you tell us about one of the early cases that you guys did?
After
you started your group? Anything come to mind, like your first case, your first...
Well, the very, very first case was at a college campus here in New Jersey. It was way back, gosh, yeah, 1993, when I was still married to my first husband. And we decided we wanted to do this, so we printed up business cards and we gave the name Ghost Hunters Incorporated and sent them out to all like the New Age and metaphysical bookstores within New Jersey with a little cover note saying, hey, you know, we're here, we're going to do ghost hunting or paranormal investigating, with, you know, if anybody comes in your store and has a situation, would you pass our card out? And a few weeks later, I got a call from Audrey, who had a store in Denville, and it was called Audrey's Inner Visions. And she said, I had three girls in here this afternoon from Fairleigh Dickinson. You're probably going to get a call from one of them. They have a situation. And she said, actually, she goes, I'm worried for them. So, you know, I hope you can help them. And the very next message on the answer machine was one of the girls saying, this is, you know, saying her name, her phone number, please get back to me. We really need your help. We got your card from Audrey. So I called her back and started listening to some of the stuff that was going on. And they were being terrorized at this point. you know. And I said, okay, well, let me see if I can set up a babysitter for our son, and as soon as my husband gets home, we'll be there. So we did. We dropped off our son to his mother, you know, my mother-in-law at the time, and drove up to Madison and went in, and we did the whole, you know, writing down the notes, taking all the history, interviewing each one of these girls. But the funniest thing was, as we walk, it's a nice little, like, it was a nice new dorm building, and their room, when you first walk in, they had a nice, like, living room area, and then you would go down the hallway, and they had a bathroom that had two shower stalls and three toilets and three sinks, and then they had three bedrooms coming off that hallway. And the very last bedroom at the end of the hallway on the left-hand side was where all their mattresses were thrown on the floor. And all three girls were staying together. They had worked out the buddy system. If any one of them had to go to the bathroom, one of the other ones went in the bathroom and sat there with them because they were so scared. They would sleep together, either hang out in the living room together or go, take turns going to the bathroom together. They could not be apart. And the real kicker for me, which really drove it home that this was at a terror level, none of their boyfriends would spend the night.
Wow.
Oh, this is bad, you know. So all the guys were like, okay, gotta go, see ya. Yeah.
So what did you find on your investigation then?
Well, they showed us, you know, the different, how they heard the sound of the one girl. What could happen was the one girl could hear the entity but not see it, and the other girl could see it but not hear it, and the third girl just was terrified. She would get the cold sensations and see the rabbit, that they had a little rabbit in a cage in the living room, and the rabbit would freak out right before something like this thing would manifest. And you know, when we were doing the investigation and they led us around, they said, well, these are the blinds that we swore it sounded like somebody threw a rock at, but there was nothing there and no damage was done. And the girl who could see this thing manifest, she said, you know, and it was in the very last bedroom where they had all their beds, she said, it always comes out of the closet. And she pointed to the closet, and it was like those sliding door closet, and we slid the door open, and Jeff's like, well, what's on the other side of this wall? And the girls were like, oh, the bathroom. And we looked at each other, we're like, well, there's our water source. You know, that's why this thing keeps coming back and forth through here, because the water conducts electricity. It's a good way for something to manifest and draw energy off of. So anyway, I sat in the hallway by myself to kind of I used to do shorthand. So I took a lot, even though I would record the interview, I always did shorthand in my notes to kind of back it up. Because a lot of times you'd go out to your car and you'd put the tape in the tape deck. Yes, this is back when there were tape decks in cars. And you would listen to it and it would all be static, you know, and you were like, great. So I always did shorthand just to back up all the notes. And I said, you know what, Jeff, why don't you go down in the living room, sit with the girls. And at this point, two of the boyfriends had showed up. So the boyfriends were telling Jeff all their stories and stuff. And I sat down the hallway on the floor, and I started transcribing my notes. And all of a sudden, I got this, I just stopped writing, and I looked straight ahead of myself, and I had that feeling of, you know what, on the count of three, you better get up and run. And I actually counted in my head to three, stood up, and as I started running down the hall, I heard all the girls in the living room, they started screaming, and I came right around the corner. They're like, oh, my God, it just went by you. So the girl who could see it, she saw this big black shadow of a thing go right by me as I came around the corner, and the rabbit was doing backflips in the cage. They said that's what clued them off, was the rabbit started jumping around and acting all skittish, and then the one girl could hear it, and the other girl could see it, and they started screaming, and I was coming down the hallway, and the thing went right by me.
So how'd you feel?
Well, that freaked me out, you know, the fact that they started screaming and stuff, but it also proved to me that even though I didn't see it and didn't smell it, touch it, feel it, or anything, I did know, sitting in the hallway by myself, you know, like I said, I had that feeling of, on the count of three, you better run. That I knew something wasn't right and something was coming.
So, Laura, what was it doing? How was it interacting? Was it an intelligent haunting? Was it interacting with the girls, or what was it doing to get them so freaked out?
Yeah, it basically was getting stronger in power because it was terrorizing them, and the fear was feeding it and making it stronger. The one girl was dabbling in witchcraft, Not that
okay.
there's anything wrong with witchcraft, but you know, if you're not raised in it and you don't and you dabble, you know, you can manipulate energies to a not so good degree. And the other girl brought home a Ouija board one day and said, wouldn't this be fun? And they started playing it thinking, oh, this is fun. And what a lot of people don't realize is it's not just fun. Even though Milton Bradley or Parker Brothers, whoever it is who markets it now to ages 8 and up, it's not just a board game. It really is a portal, and you open up this portal, and more often than not, since it's such a low vibratory tool and like attracts like, you're opening up a portal to a yuck realm, you know. So I always tell people, think of your murderers, your rapists, your child molesters, all the yuck of society on this side. That's what's on the other side of the Ouija board, and that's what you're opening the door and saying, hey, come on in, you know. So
these girls
they
were all
had that
kind
going
of,
on. Huh?
So these girls had all been kind of dabbling with that. Any idea how long they had been doing that before the entity started to manifest itself?
They had been playing the Ouija board for about a month and a half, 2 months, and you know, a couple weeks into it, they, you know, it was little things of like, did you hear that? No. Okay. Did you see? No. And they said, you know, and it wasn't until things got real bad that they started charting back and saying, whoa, you know, this was going back to when that night when we had that one session and the board went all crazy and, you know, and then they started realizing it was those little things. But then, like I said, it got to the point where this thing, the one girl said the one time she was sitting on her bed, and this was in the other room when she still had her bed in her own room, and she's the one who could hear it. She was sitting on her bed. She was doing homework. And she said she could hear as clear as day as this thing just, like, said this vulgar word right in her ear. And, she turned, and nobody was there, and she said it freaked her out, and she ran out of her room. And then the other one could see this thing, like, come out of the closet, stand up, and then walk as if it was going to go out the door to the hallway, but would vanish by the time it hit the door. And it was scaring them, so they'd scream, and, you know, and I'm like, well, now you're giving it even more energy, and it's, you know, you've got to banish this thing. You're going to have to do some heavy-duty cleansing. And
yeah, so did you guys help them with that back then?
I gave them a, you know, I said, you've got to just go, whatever your supermarket where they have those candles in the glass, I said, just get a bunch of white candles and glass, you know. I said, you've got to infuse white light. You're going to have to smudge this place. If you can get a, you know, some white sage or a sage bundle from a, you know, go back to the Audrey's Inner Vision and buy one there. And I said, smudge the place, sea salt in every outer corner, and get white candles throughout the night to keep infusing white light. And I said, and whatever you do, no cursing, no crying, no fighting on the phone with your boyfriend, no having anybody over here doing any foul language or any kind of aggression or depression, nothing negative. I said, keep it as light and positive as you possibly can. I said, in fact, why don't you just invite some of your friends over and have a nice party? I said, no alcohol, no drugs, because those are depressants. I said, just a nice get-together where everybody just kind of hangs out and just kind of raises the vibration here after you've done some of this cleansing. And I said, if you need me sooner, call me. Otherwise, I'll call you in 2 weeks. And 2 weeks later, I called them, and they said, wow, it was so much better, and that they felt a lot better. And I said, well, just keep going with it. And then they were like, we can't wait for the semester to be over.
All right. Well, cool. Got a last question.
Coming up on break.
Coming soon. Go ahead if you've got something, though.
I was just going to say, in your experiences, Laura, do you frequently, even back then, or even as opposed to now, did you find yourself having to do more kind of cleanings and help folks with that?
You know, not too many. A lot of times when we concluded an investigation, we'd take our time, go over all the data, pull together what we call the report of findings, which we still do to this day, and we'd give it to the homeowner. And if it was conclusive that they had like a spirit, more like, you know, a real spirit, something that, like you said, had an intelligence to it and was interacting, you know, if it's a ghost, where if it's just like the former owner of the house who's just refusing to accept the fact that he's dead and really needs to move on, you know, and if that's the conclusion you've drawn, you would go to the homeowner and say, this is what we found. You know, we looked him up. Here's, you know, going through the house, you know, the mortgage records, who owned the property, blah, blah, blah. This is who it kind of syncs up to be, given the history of the property and what we found and what if you got EVPs and it was a male voice and saying certain clues and what have you. And we give them their options. You know, like, you can coexist with this. You can opt to have us try and cleanse it and get it out. Or you can go your religious path, you know, whether you want a priest to come in or a rabbi or a shaman, you know, what have you. Or you can sell your house and move. It's none of those are options for you. And over the years, most people said, believe it or not, most people said, we'll just deal. You know, it's not a terrifying experience. It's a little unsettling, but for the most part, we'll deal. We'll coexist. A few people did opt to say, you know what, come in and get rid of it. Like the one house that we did at Metuchen, it turned out it was, this house was built kind of like in a subdivision setting, what used to be one huge estate that had a mansion on the property, you know, like a huge house, and it had a formal ballroom and a big organ in the thing. And over the years, the house kind of whittled down. Eventually, they knocked it all down and subdivided this property and put these more modern houses on it. And these people called us in. They were having problems where they would hear this organ music playing in the middle of the night, and they didn't have an organ in the house. The husband of in the household, he got up one night and went to the bathroom, and on his way back, he said he heard this like man like in the hallway laughing. And he ran back to his room, grabbed his baseball bat. He figured somebody broke in, and yet he went all through the house, couldn't find him. And then the wife would fight to have her television watch Melrose Place, and it would keep flipping over to a Yankees game if the Yankees were playing. And long story short, we found out it was originally owned by one of the executive producer of the Howdy Doody show. Hmm. And he was giving his clues by laughing, and then the thing, you know, being a Yankees fan and so forth. And so she had us cleanse the place, and I called her 2 weeks later, and I said, well, how is everything? And she said, it's so quiet. Can you bring them back?
All right, cool. Good story. Good experience. All right, we're going to take a break. Before we do, just a couple of things. If you are joining us, we're glad everybody's in the chat room with us. And if you have questions, you can certainly ask them in chat. You can also call in live. The number is there on your screen. It's 347-945-7799 if you have any questions for Laura. We are talking with Laura Hladek from the New Jersey Ghost Hunting Society, Hunter Society, I should say, right, Laura? And when we come back, we're going to take some live calls. I know we've got one that will be coming in. So if you want to dial up during the break here, you can, or just after the break is fine as well. Hang with us. We'll be back with Laura in just a minute. Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's Spirit Team with one T,
www.thebeatles.org. And we are back. This is Doug Kelly, co-host of Spirit Team Paranormal Universe, with Grant, my co-host. Hey, Grant.
Hey, everybody. Welcome.
And we are talking with Laura Hladek from the New Jersey Ghost Hunter Society. Welcome back, Laura.
Oh, hi. Welcome back to you, too.
Thank you. We've been talking about some of Laura's experiences with her group and in the early days and how she got started and so forth. And one of the things that places that Laura's been is Gettysburg, right, Laura? I mean, you guys did Ghost World up in that neck of the woods.
Exactly, yeah, last July.
Mm-hmm.
I've been out there many times before that. We've even done a New Jersey Ghost Conference out in Gettysburg as well. I mean, it's an amazing place. I mean, not only is it just beautiful, it's just beautiful for the landscape, but if you're a historian, it holds a lot of value for you, obviously, and if you're a paranormal person, it's extraordinary. I always tell people, you know, if you go out to Gettysburg and you come back without one single orb shot or anomaly, hang up your camera as a ghost hunter. I don't want to talk to you.
Fine. Well, listen, we have a caller online, Gregory, who has a question or two about that. So, Gregory, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on the phone. How are y'all doing?
Always. You have a question for Laura?
Hey, Laura, I saw where you went to Gettysburg and also to Myrtle's Plantation. Can you tell us a little more about that? Did you have any paranormal experiences, anything of that nature?
Oh, yeah. Which one you want first, Myrtles or Gettysburg?
Let's start with Gettysburg first, then we'll get into Myrtles. Then I'm going to hang
up. Okay. All right. The Gettysburg, the first time I remember, my first husband and I, when we first went out there, it was for an International Ghost Hunter Society ghost conference. And the first night, we were staying the Friday and Saturday night in the Holiday Inn Battlefield to attend the conference. And the first night, I went to sleep, not a problem. The next day at the conference, he kept yawning, and I'm like, what's wrong with you? And he goes, I couldn't sleep last night. He goes, I kept feeling like somebody was in the room staring at me, and I would look, but I wouldn't see anything. And I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. So that night, he sleeps like a log, and I'm tossing all night looking like I knew what he meant. It felt like the minute you would open your eyes, you thought you were going to see somebody standing at the foot of the bed, and I would kind of peek, and then I wouldn't see anything, and I'd try to sleep again, and I couldn't. So Sunday at the conference, I was yawning all day. And from there, it's like we found out how people were just leaving their digital recorders and stuff on their beds in the Battlefield Holiday Inn while they would take a shower, come out, and they would have, like, Civil War tunes and a female's voice being hummed and all this amazing stuff. I mean, the place is just crawling with them. And then I stayed at the Cashtown Inn, and that's where I felt the ghost in this one particular room tug on my toe, you know, at the foot of the bed. And it felt like somebody was walking, you know, when someone walks too close to the bed and their leg drags and kind of pulls on the blanket. And I thought that's what it was until I really woke up and looked and realized, no, I'm alone, you know. So, yeah, that's Gettysburg. And I've stayed at the Myrtles Plantation. And the first night we stayed there, it was in the John Leek room. And I think for the most part, I freaked out the other guests more so than I captured anything paranormal, because I was up all night, you know. I just, every time a thing clicked, I was like turning over, you know, putting in new batteries, putting in new film, putting in a new disc, running around. I'd sneak out into the hallway, I'd take pictures, come back in the room, and, you know. And the next morning at the breakfast buffet, I hear these people saying, did you hear that noise in the hallway last night? I know, I heard it too. And I'm like, and I start laughing. I'm like, I'm sorry, guilty. That was me, you know. But, and then the next night, we stayed in the caretaker's cottage, which, when I saw this on Ghost Hunters, that TV show, they called it the slave shack or something, but the time, I don't know, maybe in its day, it's where the slaves stayed, but we booked it and reserved it, and it was called the caretaker's cottage. And it's just this one room, long little, like, bungalow thing with the Ma and Pa kettle porch on the front and little picket fence running around it. And it has no central heating, no central air conditioning. They give you those little thermo block, you know, ceramic block heaters. That's all you had to, like, stay warm in here. And then there was one, like, you know, the heater and ceiling fan and exhaust fan in the bathroom. So it had those three switches, one for the light, one for the heat, and one for the exhaust fan in the bathroom. And I remember, you know, like I said, it's railroad car style. And I'm sitting on the bed putting my sneakers on. And my friend was standing there in the doorway towards the bathroom. And he's like, do you want me to leave the heater on in the bathroom? And I said, nah, shut it off, because we were going to go out and walk the property and take some day shots and stuff. And all of a sudden, he comes walking over to me. He goes, you ready? And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, give me a second. I just got to finish tying my shoe. So he kind of like rushes, gives me the bum's rush out the door. And I'm like, what is your rush? And he goes, You didn't walk by me and turn that off, did you? I'm like, how could I walk by you? You would know it, because you could see me coming. You would have seen me go by you. I'm sitting there putting my sneakers on. He goes, okay, then something freaky just happened, because after I asked you if you wanted me to turn the heater off and you said, you know, yeah, turn it off, he went to turn it off and it was already off, and he knew he had it on. That's why he was asking me, do you want me to turn it off? So it totally scared him, so I let him walk it off around the property, and then, you know, really creeped him out. Then that night I wake up, I'm like, okay, it's 11 o'clock, I got to hit the ground running, I want to go out and do some night shots. And he's like, I'm coming. I said, really? He's like, you're not leaving me alone in here. And he was so exhausted. He's like, 11 o'clock at night, she starts, and I'm like, I'll be up all night, sorry. He's like, well, then I'm trailing along. He goes, because you're not leaving me alone in here.
Well, tell us about your most memorable investigation over the years.
I think the weirdest one, and it was a two-parter, basically. The first part was what you would do as your normal investigation, where we got the phone call, talked through things with the woman, and to ascertain, you know, the level and the degree of what was going on, and yet warranted an investigation. And this was a different house down in Metuchen, same town. And this was in the very early days. I had a friend of mine who was very into the ghost hunting that we were doing, and this was before New Jersey Ghost Hunters. So my friend, she's a Reiki master, very psychically gifted. She went with us, so it was that was Angela, myself, my then-husband Jeff, and then we had a friend of ours who was a cop in town named Chris, and he went. Now, because he was all intrigued in this, too. That's actually what brought him into my... I used to have a little New Age bookstore in town. And, you know, you faint every time, like, a cop pulls up and starts to walk in your store. You're like, oh, God, what did I do wrong now, you know? And they have, like, this requisite in Westfield that no cop can be below 6'5". So they're all, like, gigantic, gargantuan cops in this town. So this moose comes walking into my store. But he had seen the ghost hunter sign in the window, and he was interested and said how he lived on the corner of the cemetery. Ooh, how nice is that? So we got to be buddies and blah, blah, blah. So I said, do you want to go on this investigation with us? He's like, I would love it. So we went down. We met with these people. We did the whole interview process. They started to walk us through their home. And I remember the father of the family, the husband slash father, he was very, you know, like, defensive, almost, like, sneering at us, like, what are you people doing here? It was his attitude, like, this is all a bunch of crap, you know. I'm like, okay, whatever, you know, you're entitled to your opinion. As we're walking through, we get to the teenage daughter's bedroom, and she's got all her Barbie dolls have been decapitated. Their heads are hung from fishing line throughout the ceiling of her bedroom with Marilyn Manson makeup jobs put on them.
Jeez.
And the decapitated bodies are in a basket in the corner of her room. She has a self-portrait of herself that she did in art class painted, and it's really a good likeness, except she painted herself with no mouth. Now, the cop friend of mine, he's standing there, he's like, you know what, we're trained to profile people. He goes, that's disturbing. You know? He goes, that's disturbing.
Any issue?
And then the real kicker was the one Marilyn Manson Barbie doll head that she had suspended right above her pillow was on this fishing line, but then she had a chicken bone, like a leg of a chicken bone, and a red ribbon wrapped around that and tied and suspended. And when Angela saw it, she's like, you know, that's indicative of Santeria or something. She goes, I don't know, but that doesn't look... I'm like, yeah, that doesn't look good. And then they had the three kids. The oldest one, who had the very first experience with this entity, he had it happen to him when he was 18 years old, and he had decided, you know, this is it. I'm going to go downstairs to their basement. The one part of the finished basement, he was going to convert that into his little bachelor pad. So the middle child, his younger brother, got the room that they shared. He got that to himself, and the daughter had her own room, and the parents had their room. So this was 5 years prior when this older kid, the 18-year-old, moved down the basement. He got attacked by this thing. Now it's 5 years later, and this thing has attacked the middle child and is also making the older son, who at the time was 18, now he's like 20-something, he's married, has a kid of his own. Yeah, the kid's 5 years old, it's 5 years later. And when the kid stays at Grandma and Grandpa's house, ends up, they find him sleepwalking, and then he talks about, Batman made me do this, Batman wants to kill my daddy. The kid was only 5, so he could only describe this entity as Batman, but what he was really seeing was this elemental with the very pointed ears and the troll-like face. And you know, he drew pictures of it, and a neighbor who also saw this entity at one point drew the same picture without having seen what the kid had drawn. So that's kind of getting ahead. But we did this initial investigation and found out eventually, you know, that the teenage daughter was a little on the disturbed side in that she was messing with witchcraft with her one friend who was totally into it. They had played a Ouija board, and they figured maybe that's at one of her parties. And, it was actually the parent condoned it. She was having, like, a sweet 16 birthday party for sleepover for her daughter, and she said, oh, here's the Ouija board, girls. Why don't you sit up tonight and play this? Lovely. So between Little Miss, you know, Wicca Wannabe and all this stuff going on in, you know, this girl's head, they were just prime target to open this portal and bring this thing in. But, and that's what happened. That this thing was now manifesting where it could really come in the house. And it turned out to be an elemental. And we didn't even know. It was funny, the first investigation, you know, there were those disturbing qualities. We were finding out this information. We knew the history generally of Metuchen, that it was a heavily American Indian-based area. And in fact, they have an Indian burial ground there with the one symbol on the gate. And even the squad cars of the police department have, like, I think it's an Indian head or some type of Indian symbol on their squad cars. So it's got that whole thing going on. We knew that, but we couldn't figure out what this was. And the people said, look, you know, it's attacked the other son. It's terrorizing our daughter. We want whatever this is out of here. And I said, well, you know what, we'd have to spend an all-nighter to really come back and do this justice because, you know, it wasn't coming out that night when we were there. And they're like, not a problem. We'll go down to our shore house. Here's the keys. You can have the house. So we're like, all right. So we came back the following weekend, and we did an all-nighter. And while we were there, we kept getting whiffs of this rotting flesh smell. I don't know how else to describe it other than, like, rotting flesh. It was just putrid odor. And it would come, and it would leave. And we started, we knew they had a huge dog, and we were looking to see if maybe the dog had been chewing a piece of meat or a bone and left it under a counter or a couch or something. And all of a sudden, as we're looking frantically for this, I stand up and I'm like, wait a minute. If something's rotting, you're going to constantly smell it, and it's going to be concentrated in one spot where it's actually rotting. This was coming and going, and in different places. If you were in the kitchen, all of a sudden you'd smell it, and if you wouldn't, you'd be in the... And the main room where it really kept happening was the family room, the den, towards the back of the house. So we decided we would, you know, we set up some cameras in different areas of the house, but we would kind of make base camp in the den. There was a beanbag chair, and we said, that'll be our bed. We'll take turns. Each person can sleep for 30 minutes, and the others stand guard. And they're like, well, Laura, why don't you take the first nap? I'm like, all right, fine. So I fall asleep, and all of a sudden I start smelling that putrid odor, and that's what wakes me up. And I'm, like, smelling it, and I kind of sit up, and I'm trying to focus my eyes, and I can really smell it so strongly. I'm like, guys, are you getting this? Are you taking any pictures? And then I hear, like, coming from another room. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? So I get up, and I stumble from the dark, and they're all sitting in the living room, giggling their heads off, like, ha ha, we left you in there alone. I'm like, well, while you're out here thinking you're so funny, it's in there, and you missed it, you know? But this is the sick stuff that ghost hunters play, you know, back then.
Well, you've got to have some fun.
Yeah, right. Oh, see, we scared you. I'm like, but you missed it, you know? And, sure. And a true ghost hunter does not run from it. We run towards it, and I'm like, and you missed it, you know? But we spent the night, and it was interesting. The next, as soon as the sun was coming up around 5:30 in the morning, we started packing up the equipment. And Angela brought her husband, who is a professional photojournalist photographer for a local paper. I think it was for the Courier News at the time. And so he was able to borrow all this high-end, you know, like $1,500 and, you know, $1,000 worth, I don't know, with how many thousands of dollars worth of camera equipment that he brought from work, you know, for this investigation. Plus we had our stuff, the Iowa boombox, you know. But sad to say, we got home and we were trying to review the data, and the boombox did not function after that, so that we kissed goodbye. The camcorder, the tape was destroyed. The camcorder continued to function. We could put other tapes in and record, but the tape from that night was destroyed. And the pictures that I took pictures of these weird pod-like fingerprints that were left in the dust on the top of the television set when this thing attacked the middle son. And he struggled with it, and he remembered that at one point he pushed up against it, and it must have tried to reach out to balance itself, and it left its handprint on top of the TV in the dust. I took pictures of all that, Every picture I took on that roll of film turned out perfectly, except for the pictures of the fingerprints. The Courier News photographer, he had the same problem. Any picture that would have been of any value did not turn out. And the sad thing was, one of the most expensive cameras that he owned ceased to function after that. So this thing was coming and going and kind of checking us out that night, but it wasn't going to totally reveal itself. And so we still didn't really know what it was. So about a week goes by, and I'm sitting up late one night, you know, watching TV. We used to have, like, this den area in the basement of our house, and everybody else was upstairs asleep. And I'm watching these series of Ghosts Of, and there was Ghosts of England and Ghosts of Scotland. And they said, coming up, Ghosts of Ireland. I'm like, all right, one more Ghosts Of, and then I promise I'm going to bed, you know. So I'm watching the show, and it gets to where it talks about Lepp Castle or Leap Castle.
Lepp Castle, yeah.
Lepp, yeah. And they talk about that and how this woman had described it, this elemental, and they did the reenactment of it on the show. And when the camera showed what this thing, she described what it would look like, and they reenacted it, I took one look at it, and I'm like, oh, my God. I just sat up on the couch. I'm like, that's the thing in Metuchen. And then she went on to say how it had this horrific, putrid, rotting flesh smell. And I'm like, oh, that is it. So I jump on the computer with my fancy dial-up modem, and I email up to the Paranormal Research Society in New England, which was headed up at the time by Ed and Lorraine Warren, and I sent them an email saying, please send me any information you have, anything you know about elementals. And I got an email back the next day, and they were detailing, you know, that they're mostly locality-based. They typically stay outside. They're of the elemental kingdom, but chiefly they are an inhuman entity. They've never had a human incarnation. That's why they pretty much stay outside. It has to be something very traumatic or whatever that opens a portal or something that draws them in to a building, like in Lepp Castle. And then apparently with them messing with the Ouija board, and the witchcraft in this house, they opened that portal. And the main thing, it was coming in and out of the house through the area of the dining room. And when we said, well, what's on the other side of the dining room wall? And we ran outside and looked, there was a spigot for them to attach their hose, their garden hose. And I'm like, well, there's your water source. So this thing was coming from the outside in through that and getting enough energy to get stronger and stronger by attacking. When I asked the middle son, I was like, so you fought with it? He said, yeah. He goes, because every time I went to punch it, he said it was like if you took a leather bag and filled it with water and tried to hit that as hard as you could. He goes, that's what it felt like I was hitting. And he goes, and I couldn't see it. He said, I know I was punching it. And he actually rolled out of his bedroom with his sister screaming her head off. She's freaking out. He's punching this invisible thing, rolling on the floor, out the door, down the hall, all the way down the stairs and into the living room. And his parents, they hear all this commotion. They turned the light on. They came out, and they thought their son was having an epileptic fit. And I'm not being sarcastic, but that's what they thought. Oh, my God, he's having a seizure, because all they saw him was thrashing around and punching. And finally it was over, and he was trying to tell them, but look, you know, this thing was attacking me. And that's when it harkened back to the oldest son when he was originally attacked, when he set up his little bachelor pad there in the basement. He heard something scuffling in the room, and he turned the light on. He didn't see anything. He turned it off, went to bed. He heard it again, didn't see anything, turned the light back off. And he said next thing he knew, this thing jumped on him, and he was fighting with it. And it actually burned its four pod-like fingerprints into, like, the area, the side of his rib cage. And they showed me, they took pictures of it. They were smart enough to do that way back then. And they showed us the pictures, and they said, now look at these pod prints, fingerprints in top of the dust on the TV. And they were the same that looked like in the photo that were burned into the sun 5 years previous. So, you know, this thing was really strong enough to leave its mark and to attack.
That's amazing. Let me interrupt you just for a minute. Very interesting investigation. And we're going to continue discussing this one and maybe see what you guys were able to do with it and so on and so forth. Time is flying. We're at the top of the hour, near the top of the hour. Just a couple of things. If you're with us now, stay with us, because we're new to Blog Talk Radio, and it's my understanding that once 60 minutes passes, that you're not able to get into the live show anymore. Now, that's what I read. I'm not certain of it, but I think that's the way it is. So, if you're with us, Don't log out, because then you'll remain with us. And we're talking with Laura Hladek from New Jersey Ghost Hunting Hunters Society. Before we get to the break, though, I wanted to mention one other thing about the Paranexus Conference coming up in October of this year in Tampa, Florida. Please visit paranexus.org for more information. There is a link on the listing page, the main Blog Talk Radio page for Spirit Team Paranormal Universe. Got some great speakers. We've got some interesting things going on. It's going to be not only educational, but very fun. It is week before Halloween. We're going to begin on a Thursday evening. We've got a special guest, Captain Jack of Paranormal Radio, who's going to be with us. He's going to be broadcasting live Thursday night. Gregory, Spirit Team member, is going to be hosting a midnight table tipping seance. Very, very interesting potential tool that groups can use. We've also got a Paranexus Challenge scheduled for Friday night, where at least two teams are going to go out to an undisclosed as yet top-secret location and see what kind of evidence they can come up with. We're going to video broadcast that to the group live that evening. Saturday night, we're going to have a Spirits and Shadows Halloween costume ball, a little bit of fun mixed in with the education. So take a look at paranexus.org. It's going to be a top-notch, professionally delivered conference for paranormal researchers and enthusiasts. So that having been said, if you'll hang with us, we'll be back in just a minute after the break. And we'll have Laura back with us. Hang tough.
In the night, in the shadows, in the sky, it's Spiriting Paranormal Universe.
And we are back, folks. This is Doug Kelly, Spirit Team Paranormal Universe, with my co-host Grant Rubendunce. Welcome back, Grant.
Hey, it's good to be here.
And we are talking with our special guest, Laura Hladek from the New Jersey Ghost Hunter Society. Welcome back, Laura.
Hi, thanks again for having me on. This is fun.
Yeah, you do great. Very interesting stuff. We were talking about an investigation that you were doing, one of your most weird, I guess, investigations, and you'd been explaining that just before the break. So let's pick up on that. You had done your initial all-nighter, and then you, a week or so later, you were watching some documentaries that kind of gave you some clues as to what you might be dealing with. That is an elemental. You contacted Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Right.
And then you got some info on it. So you want to pick it up from there?
Yeah, when they wrote back to me and they told me, you know, that this is an inhuman entity. It's never had a human incarnation. It usually stays out within nature. It takes something traumatic or someone dabbling stuff they shouldn't be dabbling to kind of open that portal and kind of invite it in. So it was amazing that it was almost like one of those aha moments of, it was a good thing I stayed up that night to watch that show. I never would have really figured this out otherwise. And getting the confirmation back from, you know, from the Warrens and everything, and they were warning me too. They said, you know, this is nothing, it's not kid stuff, it's nothing to just take lightly, this is serious, this thing, because it's never had a human incarnation, it is completely amoral, and it won't think twice of hurting you or doing any kind of damage because it has no boundaries. It has no moral barometer whatsoever, you know. So they can run that. Sometimes, you know, certain elementals, like if you want to, the sprites and fairies fall in that realm. And they can be mischievous and do little fun things, kind of tease you and pick on you, but also do favors. But this type of elemental is more of the troll, more of the, like, you know, really kind of like what's in it. He's always what's in it for me, and what am I going to get out of this, and this is fun, and but has absolutely no boundary of morality whatsoever. So they warned me about that. And, you know, I pulled together all the other findings that the other investigators had, and we drew our conclusions as to what pieces of equipment didn't work anymore, and wrote everything up, and I sent it down to the homeowner, and I gave her a call, and I went over everything over the phone with her. And she's like, well, what should we do? And I said, well, you know, you could try a cleansing and try and get this thing to seal off whatever this opening is and cast this thing out and keep it out, you know. I said, you're going to have to make sure you've gotten rid of that Ouija board. Make sure your daughter's weird friend that showed up the second night while they were getting ready to leave, you could tell she was the one that had the, you know, the Wiccan wannabe influence. I'm like, make sure your daughter kind of cut the ties with her or don't bring her in the house and stop messing with things they shouldn't be messing with. And I said, you know, and hopefully you can get rid of this. And she goes, well, hopefully. And I said, yeah, I can't, I've never dealt with something like this. I said, I can come in and do a cleansing, but I can't guarantee you that it's going to work because I've never dealt with something like this. So she's like, well, would you come do the cleansing and get us started? So I went down, I did a whole smudging, and I gave him the sea salt, and I even put mirrors, little compact, like, you know, those makeup compact mirrors. I put one in each outer, facing into the corner of each outer corner of the basement to kind of, like, repel and reflect back any negativity, and I put piles of sea salt in the corner of every single room, and we smudged, and I gave them tons of those white candles. I said, make sure you keep these white candles going every night to kind of infuse the white light. And, you know, within a week, they were like, even at night, you could feel a shift in the energy. But they said, yeah, a week later, it's definitely feeling more breathable in here. Our grandson stayed over. He didn't do his sleepwalking thing. And it's feeling better. But she said, you know what? I told my husband we're putting the house on the market. And they did, and they sold it and moved.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
So they just split, and they got away from the problem. Did they have any problems, do you know, in their new location?
I never heard from them again, to be honest.
Interesting. And that was how many years ago?
That was back in, let's see, 94. Did I have him? I had him in 96. It was probably, I would say, early 97. It was either, no. I had already had, yeah, I'm trying to think, was I still, it probably was summer of 97, yeah.
Okay.
I'd have to look through my records for sure, but I'm trying to remember, was I pregnant or not?
It's those milestones in life that we never forget.
Yeah, that's how you can gauge. Like, I'm trying to picture, well, what was I wearing? Was I in my fatty maternity clothes, or was I, you know?
You know, Laura, I have a question. I was just wondering, out of all the investigations you've done, how many of the cases, or what, if you could put a percentage on it, involve people who were, number one, playing with the Ouija board, and then, number two, how many true cases of intelligent hauntings would you say you've come across since you guys have been doing the investigations?
The Ouija board thing, I can tell you this much. Every case I've ever been involved with that ends up being a hell of a lot worse than a ghost or a residual haunting, it always is like you can just do the family lineup and go right down the line and say, okay, come on, set us up. Which one of you played a Ouija board? And darn if not one of them did it. And those are the worst cases, like with this elemental. Anything I've gone into where, you know, stuff's been flying across the room and so forth, I'm like, okay, who played the Ouija board? You know. But the percentage of, I would say, interactive spirit stuff with all the cases I've been on, I would say, you know, and not every case you go on do you even find anything, you know. And you don't want to write the people off as loons because they have enough stuff that they can point out and describe that they've experienced, and you just have to be honest with them. It, you know, it's just not here tonight, you know. And the way I usually leave it with them, I'm like, all right, we didn't capture any evidence tonight, and I'm not dismissing what you tell me you've been experiencing, but if it's really something here, once we leave either tonight or tomorrow night, it's going to really react. You're going to find a spike in activity because it's going to be a little peeve that you brought us in to find it. And if the next day the phone rings, the person's like, boy, you weren't kidding. We couldn't sleep last night. I'm like, okay, so then you definitely see you're not losing your mind. And I'm like, and I'll tell them, make sure you have your camera right by your bed, you know, keep it on the nightstand, because even though we can't be here all night, you know, have some cameras ready, take some pictures. And, you know, so.
Do you ask them to journal too, Laura?
I'm sorry, what?
Do you ask them to journal take a log of the activities they're experiencing?
Oh, absolutely. Before I arrive on the scene, that's the one responsibility or whatever that I ask of the homeowner. I'm like, just think back as best you can, even if you can only write like summer of 85, you know, fall of 92, or if you can get it to a month and a year, you know, just think back and write a chronology of events, thinking back to the very first time something was weird, that it struck you as weird, all the way up to the minute I'm walking through the front door. That saves us a lot of time. When I get there, I have their chrono of events to look over. I fill out all we have a standard form with just base questions, you know, like, do you wear glasses, contact lenses, hearing aids, do you take, you know, like insulin, do you have prescription meds, do you have a history of mental illness, does your family members have a history of mental illness? And I always tell them, don't be offended by these questions, but I just have to establish a baseline for each member of the family and each person who's saying they've had an experience in this house. And we get through all of that and go over the chrono of events, and then I have them take us on a walkthrough. But to answer your question percentage-wise, I don't even want to hazard a guess, to tell you the truth, because out of all the cases I've done, there's been, I would probably say it's around 60% is a residual haunting. You know, where it's just something that's kind of locked in time. It just, it's on this loop, and it just keeps playing itself over on an anniversary or at a certain time each day.
60%,
yeah.
The places that you find activity.
Yeah, I would say, when we go in on cases and we actually end up getting some some kind of, like, whether it's photography or EVP. I mean, to me, when you get the EVPs, that takes it more to an interactive level, because if you ask the question, can you tell us your name, and you get a name, then there's some intelligence there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're walking around saying, can you tell me your name, can you tell me who's president, can you tell me what year it is, and you're not getting answers, but all of a sudden you get home and you listen to it and you hear, I like cows, and you're like, where did that come from? We weren't even talking about cows. And that's when you know, okay, this could be either an entity that has no clue that it's an entity and that it's floating through your house, and or it is a residual. It's just something that there was a person who used to say that all the time, and that's what you happen to capture at that point, you know. And so it's, you know, I would say most of them turn out to be in the residual. It's really a lot more rare to have something that's more interactive, and fortunately it's, you know, I think the elemental case was the scariest, if you want to go on the scare factor, for me, I've ever had to deal with. And that set the bar for me. At that point, I knew, forget it, you know, I will stick with ghosts. I don't even want to mess with this thing anymore. And if people call me and they say, you know, the refrigerator's levitated to the attic, I'm like, okay, well, here's a number you can call, you know. I'm not it, you know.
here's a question from the chat room. Linda asked, you have people who call you back? In other words, you know, you've gone in, you've done your thing, you try to resolve it, but it didn't take for whatever reason. Do you have people who call back and say it's still here, that sort of thing?
No, because it's, and in truth to tell, I haven't even done any cleansing since like the 90s. You know, I think everybody thinks it's very chic now. If you tell them, well, yeah, you have an entity or you have a ghost here, they're like, cool. You know, it's like, I'm like, it's not going to increase the market value on your home, you know, but I'm sure Weikert doesn't have a box on their form to check off for, like, it's haunted, you know, and your price goes up. But you know, I think most people are just intrigued with it now and actually are happy to live with it. So I haven't been doing that many cleansings. And of the ones over the years that I did, the only kind of call back thing I got or feedback was that woman saying, could you bring it back, because it was too quiet.
All right, well, here's another question from the chat room. This is from Q. He wants to know, what about Ouija boards makes them so powerful? What makes them different than any other form of communication?
He's right. It is just a tool, and it, you know, there's all different ways. You don't even need the board itself, like the game that you could pick up at Toys R Us. I mean, you can just draw out the letters, the yes and no and goodbye, and turn a shot glass over and put your fingers on the shot glass, and it'll move around and work like a Ouija board. But for some reason, and I don't know why, but it just seems to have this very low vibration to it, and it just seems to bring in the yuck of the yuck. And, you know, I'm sure you still run the risk of possession and stuff by just doing table tipping and table wrapping and so forth. That's always a risk. But for some reason, the Ouija board seems to be the chief in this department. I mean, to give you a classic example, I'll never forget it. And this goes way back in my early days of stupidity, I mean research, when we were playing the Ouija board. And my then husband decided, you know, I want a real Ouija board. He's like, I want a wooden one of the classics. Well, I looked up and found there was a store in New York City called the Magical Child. And I called up and they said, yeah, we have wooden Ouija boards. And I'm like, oh, cool. So on a sunny, beautiful Saturday afternoon, you know, the little suburbiites, my husband and I and my best friend Teresa and a friend, our neighbor actually, Brett, because the four of us used to get together on a Friday or Saturday night and play the crummy Ouija board, because it was so entertaining. We were having so much fun with it. And our chief goal was to get the lottery numbers, the pick six, you know. That's what we were doing. Exactly. So we went into New York, the four of us, and it's a beautiful sunny day. We park on the street. We walk in, and you walk into the store. Let me tell you, it was like walking into night. It was all dark. This is like, you know, you take your goth and your emo kids today to the 10th power. That's what this store was. I mean, the people in there looked like they would split your throat in a New York minute. I mean, with anything that could be bolted or pierced was, anything that could be spiked and standing out of their head was, and all kinds of chains and you name it. I mean, it just looked like, oh, my God. And here we are, little Mr. and Mrs. Suburbia walking in. I'm like, oh, it was like, you know, it was tattooed across our foreheads of, like, mug us now, you know. So we walk into the store, and these people look like they're ready to kill us, and, you know, my husband walks up to the one guy who's standing there, you know, with the thing through his nose, and he's got chains, and he's got his arms crossed, he's all tattooed, and my husband looks at him, and he goes, yeah, I'd like to get a Ouija board, and all of a sudden, this guy, who looks like he would kill you, drops his arms and backs up and goes, okay, hold on a second. And he runs in back, and he disappears. So we're standing there going, okay, what's up with this? And we start to look around. All the other staff members are all backing up and behind their showcases, and they're, like, getting away from us. We're like, you know, we didn't ask for the plague of death here. We just asked for a Ouija board. And the kid comes back out, and he hands it to Jeff real quick. He goes, here you go. And Jeff's like, okay. And the kid's like, I don't even want to touch it, man. He goes, it's $70, you know, take it or leave it. And we're like, all right, we'll take it. You know, so it was $70, and we took it home. We started playing it that afternoon, and, oh, isn't this fun? This is neat. And you know what? 2 weeks later, we hit 4 out of the 6 numbers, and we won $72. So we were $2 up on the investment.
Well, that's good.
But that can give you an example, though. I mean, here are these people that were so into all this dark, magical stuff, and they didn't even want to touch the Ouija board. That's how it is negative. I mean, we ended up, little did we know, but we ended up, you know, when I finally get my own book done, I'm writing a book now on just the ghost hunting of New Jersey, but I had already written this whole chapter up for my own ghost book, kind of like my ghost chick's diary, and in that I describe and tell all the details of doing this Ouija board, and let me just tell you, from personal experience, it opened up a portal. This wicked entity came through. It took one psychic, like Jane Doherty, who's a very good psychic medium. She came to the house. She couldn't even get into our son's bedroom. The thing was repelling her so badly. She went down to the basement where we would sit and play the board on the card table, and she said she could feel this pillar, that this portal that we had opened. And then it took a following psychic, R. Neville Johnston from Washington, D.C., who spent the night in our son's bedroom, and it took him 2 tries to get this thing to kind of go. So I can tell you, it's bad news. And, I mean, when I get the book done and this chapter comes out, if people would read it, they would just freak. And whoever asked about why is the Ouija board so negative, just trust me, it is. I can tell you from personal experience, if you want your life to go to hell in a handbasket very quickly, there you go.
All right, well, here's a follow-up question from Q, the same person. He is asking, could it be the intent of what it's being used for? For example, I mean, I've used Ouija board, never had a single problem ever. In fact, I can't get the thing to react. Q, who I happen to know, has used it. Again, no adverse reaction. So when you think about a Ouija board versus a upside-down shot glass versus any other form of spirit communication, the question is, could it be the intent that it's used for? What do you think about that?
There's some truth into, I don't know so much the intent. With the Ouija board, I had gotten, I mean, even when I was in London, I picked up a book written by this one witch about how successful he was with the Ouija board. And I've had all kinds of books on it. The one book I can tell you to get is by Stoker Hunt, and it's called Ouija, The Most Dangerous Game. That will give you a real good insight of, it starts off with the good stuff. There's some, you know, with the patient's worth, that entity that was channeled through, and volumes of prize-winning literature, you know, via the Ouija board. But the rest of the book is basically what we deal with, which is all the negative possession and progressive entrapment and all that stuff that ensues by playing the Ouija board. It's not so much intent. From a lot of books that I read, the chief warning was know who you're playing it with and never play it alone. You need someone else there because in case something comes through and it starts to possess you, you need someone else there to command it to go to goodbye. And you should know who you're playing with. Now, the very, very first time that this board showed up in our house was my best friend Teresa brought it in with her then-boyfriend Bob. She and Bob had played it at her house and had a very scary experience. Brought it to my house, and I was like, I remember this from when I was a kid, you know, at the babysitting home. These things don't work. And my one friend Larry got up from the table, and he stood across the kitchen. He said, I've had priests in my house. They've always warned us since I was a kid not to mess with that. I'm standing over here. And I was waiting for him to crack a smile because, you know, that's how he is, and he didn't. And that's when it kind of freaked me out. I'm like, boy, he's really serious. And it took us, we clocked it. We started at 10 o'clock at night. It took 55 minutes for us to get that planchette to move. And then it started to spiral out of control, and Teresa said to send it to goodbye. But then as time went on, we kept playing it. And that was the only time her boyfriend Bob was in her house, because Bob ended up getting electroshock therapy and bouncing off rubber walls because he was a little not stable. So when you fast forward, and it's 2 years later, and we find out we've got all these problems and infestation in our house and all this crap, and it's all tracing back to the Ouija board, and I start reading all these other books, and they said, know who you're playing with. If you are playing with someone who is unstable, who is depressed, who is a substance abuser, they have gaping holes in their aura, which means they can have all kinds of negative entities already attached to them, and they sit down to play the board, and that portal opens, and wham, these things come right in. And that's when I thought, oh my gosh, we had played it, and that night Bob was here, and look where he ended up, and sure enough, you know.
So there seems to be a thread here, a commonality of stability, of mental mindset, which
mm-hmm.
is kind of redundancy, but, you know, I work for the Department of Redundancy Department. And, you know, so your mindset, your attitude, your intent.
And, I mean, we tried everything. We did all the precautions that people told us, but I think it was too late because that very first night that we played it and we didn't really know what we were doing and Bob was there and then all the I read all these things about precautions that you should, you know, take frankincense, incense, and, like, you know, light it and, you know, like, circle it all the way around to make a circle around the area that you're going to play in. Never use myrrh, because myrrh is dark, frankincense is light. That's why usually you have the two together as a high church blend is for balance. But if you were doing the Ouija board, they said only use the light, the frankincense, light a white candle. This one guy told me that you have a cup of water and you put a teaspoon of sugar in it. That way, in case anything negative does come through while you're playing the board, the sugar water is supposed to absorb it. Does it work? I have no idea. We did it anyway. I'm just telling you, these are all the precautions we took, but it might have been too late.
Right. Interesting. Okay, let's. We're coming up on a break now, and we've got quite a few people in chat. So if you've got questions, feel free to write them in chat. We'll pass them along if you'd like to call in live to ask Laura any questions. You can certainly do that. The number is on the page. I'll repeat it, though. It's 347-945-7799. And we'll take those questions. Interesting discussion. We're talking with Laura Hladek from New Jersey Ghost Hunter Society and about her many years of experience, over a decade of experience in paranormal research. And if you'll hang with us, we've got one more half hour coming up. And we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.
And we are back with Spirit Team Paranormal Universe. This is Doug Kelly with my co-host Grant Rubendunst.
Hey, everybody. Welcome.
And we're talking with our special guest, Laura Hladek from New Jersey Ghost Hunter Society. Welcome back, Laura.
Hi, Doug. Hi, Grant.
Hey, welcome back, Laura.
Hey, and for our listeners, if you've got questions, you can register for an account on Blog Talk Radio and ask a question in the chat room, or if you'd like to call in, there is a number on the screen there. We are taking live calls. We've just got about 20 or so minutes left, so if you've got a question, feel free to ask that. We've been talking with Laura about some of her investigations, some of the freaky ones. We talked a little bit about Ouija boards and so forth. Grant, any questions before I...
One question that really comes to mind, Laura, and you know, you probably have a lot more expertise on it than I do, is what's the history behind the Ouija board?
Oh, I used to know it. I used to know all the dates and stuff. I have it in a presentation somewhere. It goes back. There was actually a patent dispute at one point. William Fold, I believe, he... Yeah, originally, when they used to do like Ouija boarding. There was the planchette, which is that triangular piece of wood, and they would cut a hole in it and put a pencil in the hole, and then people would put their hands on it, and it would just rest on a plain piece of paper, and as it moved, it would kind of scrawl out its messages. And through time, and I'm not sure if it was fold, somebody developed it where they made the board, and they put the letters and the hello, goodbye, and yes and no. And Fold, I think, was the one who took the planchette and modified it. Instead of having the little hole for a pencil, he put the little magnifying glass in, and then that way you could put it on the board, and it could slide over, and it would magnify the letter or the response, which made it easier, and then people would write that down. And I think it was 1835 or something. There was a discrepancy where he actually went to court and battled over the patent for it. Some other inventor said no, he invented it or something. And over time, there's all kinds of boards out there. I mean, there's tons of pictures of all different. Some people call them talking boards, spirit circles, psychic circles. They've made them all different shapes and sizes and. But
they've been around for well over 100 years.
I think it traced back to almost like Egyptian times or something. It's a very, very old tool.
Right. Kind of like the, trying to think of the cards, the tarot cards. That you can trace all the way back to the Egyptians, or supposedly where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it is that and I know that Doug's probably asked this, but I'm just kind of curious. Why do you think it is? Is it that the Ouija board can focus the energy from folks much better than other kind of tools that makes it so powerful?
I think personally, it's more from what I've seen. It just seems to be so, like I said, low vibration. So it seems to get all the negatives, and it seems to take whatever is wrong in you or in your life and just really magnify it for some reason. And I don't know if maybe it's just... And then there's the other argument that it's not even an energy or a ghost or a spirit or a discarnate soul that's working it. It's merely people sitting there with their fingers on it. They're so intent on having something happen that they don't even know it consciously, but on a subconscious level, their brain is actually sending like these little nerve impulses, and their fingers are very subtly twitching, and they say that's what actually, it's that twitching that you don't even realize you're doing is what's making the planchette move. And having been someone who's played the board to where I've watched the planchette move so violently, you had all you could do to hold your fingers on it, I beg to differ with that. I mean, getting back to our negative experience, that one particular night, which was the last time we ever played it, we had gotten it up to the point, I don't know if you're familiar with automatic writing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Basically, when you start out, and for people that don't know, automatic writing is just kind of like taking the Ouija board to the next level. And we were always playing the Ouija board, and it turned out one night that this one particular spirit that we used to talk to, like, weekly, who was fun, he just stopped. I mean, the planchette just sat in the middle of the board, and we're like, well, where did you go? Come back. Talk to us. And I started to feel this weird tingling in my arm, and I said, oh, my God, I think he wants me to do automatic writing. So we got a pen and a paper, and I just held the pen loosely in my hand, and sure enough, my hand started to shake, and it started to do this horrible, I mean, you couldn't even decipher it, but as I got down towards the end of the page, it started to come into focus, and Brett and Teresa and Jeff, they were having a blast. They were asking questions, and now it was so much faster. I could just get all these answers down verbatim because it's faster than waiting to spell out letter by letter.
Really?
But this last night that we played it, and this is what happens, because you can get a lot of these discarnates that come through. Like I said, they're basically your lowlife. They're liars. They lie to you. They make you believe they're someone else that was near and dear to you, and they may even help you on a couple things. That's all part of progressive entrapment to get you to keep doing it. But this one night, we thought we were talking to... whatever, I think his name is Quentin, and it stopped in the middle of the board, and I said, well, maybe he's going to want me to do automatic writing. And then it started to move real slowly. We're like, okay, are you back? Where'd you go? And all of a sudden, I felt as if somebody just punched me in the stomach, and it was so violent that I took my hand off the planchette and my head slammed right onto the card table. And I had enough time to sit back up, and I could feel the rush of this energy from where it, like, punched me right in the belly button, and I could feel this energy rushing up through my stomach and into my throat, choking me. And I sat up, and I looked at Jeff and Teresa, and all I could squeak out was, he's in me. And I remember that I had all I could do to say that was, he's in me. And Jeff was so freaked out, he went, ooh, and he took his hands off the planchette. Now, thankfully, Teresa still had her fingers on it, and she was smart. She said it in such a commanding tone. She's like, goodbye. I command you, go to goodbye now. And the thing very slowly, but it slid over to goodbye. And with that, I felt the chokehold on my throat release, and I had enough time. I ran upstairs, made it to the toilet, and I threw up twice. I mean, it was that sickening and that strong. And I know to this day, had she taken her fingers off, that would have been it. I would have been left possessed by that thing.
Interesting. Well, here's a question from the chat room. Let me see if I can find it here. It's about the... when you scroll up, it's about the place that you... Here it is. From GSPR, John and Mark. This location anywhere in the world that you'd most like to investigate?
I would love to do an all-nighter at Left Castle.
Yeah.
I've been up in the Bloody Chapel. I had amazing stuff, you know, battery and camera-wise and different things captured broad daylight when I had a private tour up there with Sean Ryan. But, Sean Ryan, the tin whistle player, and he owns the castle.
Right.
And he took us up there, and but it's broad daylight, and there was neat things happening, and I thought, oh, what I wouldn't give to go back and spend the night, you know, there.
Me too. That's very interesting. I haven't been there, but you have, right? That's what you said earlier.
Right.
Yeah. You met Sean. Obviously, you've been there. Duh.
Yeah.
It's my blonde hair. Give me a break, okay?
Yeah.
All right. All right, so cool. All right, so from over the years that you have been doing this, say somebody just starting out in paranormal investigations, got any quick tips? What would you recommend that they do or don't do, maybe to avoid some pitfalls that you had to learn the hard way, things like that?
Basic safety things, you know, always have your cell phone or a two-way radio with you. I mean, we shut our cell phones off when we're investigating so it doesn't interfere, but at least you have them if you need them. Always, if you're going to go to a cemetery, go during the day. A, make sure there's no trespassing sign, and if there is, get permission. And B, get a lay of the land daytime so you don't hurt yourself at night. And I would say read. You know, you can get tons of stuff. Go to the classics like the Hans Holzer books, which will Hans Holzer, Art Myers, weird products like Weird U.S., Weird N.J. That'll give you a lot of folklore, the legends, the ghost stories as they exist. You can get yourself very well read, and then it doesn't hurt to join a reputable. Here's our plug: a reputable organization like the APHS, because you can meet other like-minded people, you can get the hands-on training, we have our protocols, and that way at least you benefit from people who are already experienced and can take you under their wing and train you so you're not just starting out and stumbling on your own.
So about the reputable group thing, why would you say something like that? I mean, we both know. I'm just drawing you out.
only because I know we set it up from a perspective of me personally, I've set it up to have no hierarchy, so there's none of that drama.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's saying, oh, I'm the leader, and I'm the, you know, no. You know, I have since gotten it to a point where I do have team leaders for the different divisions of the organization because it's grown so large, and these are people that are very near and dear to me and that I trust implicitly, so that's wonderful. But that said, it's really not like there's this hierarchy and I'm empress and, you know, they're my subjects.
Sure.
Not like that at all.
So it's not
but
a good
I think
situation.
From a reputable point of view, it's, you know, we've always operated under these set protocols and have tried and told people this is how we want you to do the investigation, just so we know if you get something, and you follow the protocols, because those are the things that a debunker is going to go right in for the kill. He's going to take one look at your photo and go, oh, it was camera strapped. Oh, you were smoking. Oh, you were, and we can say, nope, this person followed our protocols, so we know it's none of those factors.
Yeah, and plus we know that with all the insurgence of groups, the springing up of groups in the last few years, that, well, a lot of people need to get some experience and knowledge under their belt to mm-hmm. to even the protocol type of thing, right? I mean, to
exactly. And you know what I've found with the NJGHS is a lot of people join this organization, and which is great. They spin off and they do their own groups, which mm-hmm. is fine. They're mm-hmm. they're a lifetime member of us. But at least they've started their own little group to address their neck of the woods, their locality, and that's great. And that way it's kind of letting the NJGHS branch out even further via these little satellite groups. But at least you know these are groups that were originally trained,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, well, and are conducting their investigations with the same format of taking an interview and filling out a baseline form and gridding an area with EMF and, you know.
Well, that's a good segue into another point, and that is working with other groups, sharing information. You,
mm-hmm.
you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's the crux of this whole thing. It's not about, you know, yeah, every ghost hunter wants the full-body apparition photo. I mean, let's face it, that is the Holy Grail. But, you know, ultimately, this is all about the research. You know, the daily grind of being a ghost hunter is, you know, and it's not all pretty. I mean, you know, you see what the TAPS guys go through, and we do it too. You know, you're into the thrill of the hunt when you're on the ghost investigation, but that means however many hours you've put into that investigation, double that or triple it in how long it's going to take to review all that data. And it's that's not the glamorous part of it, but it's
right.
It's the necessary part, and but
yeah.
From that you start to draw certain conclusions. And gosh, how nice it would be if everybody who was drawing these conclusions posted their investigations, and we started saying, "Hey, look, there's a correlation here. Hey, I got that too. Did you get this?" Even you know, sometimes it's helped out just with figuring out there was a problem with the camera, like. In the beginning, early years, we were starting, some people were coming up and saying, look at the orb I got, it's diamond-shaped. And then I saw it from other members in different, like I would go all over the state doing investigations in various cemeteries to reach out to people and through the organization. And I started to notice that several people were coming up to me and showing me these diamond-shaped orbs. And I wrote to Dave Vester at the International Ghost Hunter Society. He said, yeah, I've seen those too. And then a couple weeks later, he wrote back and he said, I figured it out. It's the camera. He said, ask them if they're, and I forget if it was a certain model of Pentax camera, but whatever one of it, whether it was, what's the one with Canon? It was Canon. And there was a certain model of a Canon digital camera that their flash would give off a certain refraction that would actually sometimes bounce off of something and give you this diamond-shaped orb. And most recently, what we were calling ghost lightning, I have since come to realize it's the auto red eye reduction setting that people use on their cameras, and sometimes it streaks the light and it makes it look like this really freakish ghost lightning effect. And now that we've figured that out, and that's all come from sharing it and realizing, well, you got that, you got that. What kind of camera were you using? What was this? What were the conditions? And by bouncing back and forth and sharing that information, you eventually are like, well, wait a minute, what about this is a new setting. Most people, older cameras didn't have that thing where it sent out that extra flash to kind of make your eyes dilate,
right.
Bounce back, and then you take the picture, right? And that's the red eye reduction. If you
right.
Shut that off, you get rid of those ghost lightning streaks.
Right. Yeah, the camera shake and different things. Cool.
Right.
So groups should share information. That would be a good thing. And of course, that leads into the next thing about competition. You've already alluded to that. You're not really in competition with anybody because we're all after the same goal.
Yeah, to figure out, you know, are we crazy or is there really something to this?
I'm not crazy. Are you crazy, Grant?
No.
Last time I looked, I wasn't, but...
Okay. Well, okay, we're not crazy then, because we said...
Right. I mean, I know personally I've experienced something. I mean, for all intents and purposes, I will call it a ghost. And So my operate from the perspective of let's research it. Can I recreate this setting? Is there a way to finally, you know how in a science lab what they do is they control all the, you know, facets of the environment, and they nail everything down to see how many different ways they can make this thing react. And that's, as investigators, that's what we do. But with the paranormal, it's a little bit tougher. You don't really have a lab sealed environment that you can say, okay, now manifest, you know. So it's a little rougher, but I think the sharing of the information, that's where it's so critical, because we'll all be able to see common threads.
Yeah, I agree. And that's one of the, I mean, I know there's a number of websites out there that have the same goal. And that's a good thing, you know, to get everybody kind of working that way. And that's one of the things about Paranexus as well, you know, to give a forum to share information, to share findings, and to grow as a result of that. Let me ask you a question about equipment. What kind of, I know we talked about this early on in the show, but do you guys use a DVR system at all?
Digital. DVR, I mean, like, I have that at home through the cable company, but I don't.
Okay, like taps.
We've had on some investigations. It depends who's on the team and what equipment they bring with them. In the old days, we actually had the little nanny cams, and they were hardwired to VCRs. And we would set up one of those annoying Radio Shack motion detectors with the little nanny cam, and then if the motion detector went off, we knew to cut over to look through that cam to see what could have set, you know, crossed the beam and set it off. Meanwhile, it was also recording it, but this was back, like I said, in VHS days.
Mm-hmm.
There are people in the organization who have spent the bucks. I know we have, like, John and Mark Bylancic. They're one of those spinoff groups, Garden State Paranormal. And they have, infrared recording.
They're in the chat room.
Oh, hi, guys.
In fact, they asked a question about the site you wanted to visit most.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I thought that sounded familiar. I wasn't sure because I couldn't hear you too well, and I said, it sounded like Bylancic, but, well, you know.
Yeah, cool.
But yeah, they have that infrared IR camera that they're bringing up for the Burlington County Prison Museum investigation.
Well, cool. Well, let me ask you about this. Do you guys use psychics on your team?
It's not part of our process. And I've always written it off to, I just honor the fact that every person has a sixth sense, some more developed than others. And, you know, if you feel like you're picking up something, you know, point your camera in that direction, go for it. But, you know, I don't use psychics per se, because mostly what I've found is they tend to give all this drama and this romantic tale. And that's, you know, they get into this whole, like, and I'm feeling this, no, it's so painful. I'm like, well, that's not helping me. But if, you know, if a psychic shows up and says, you know what, I'm getting the name Jack Willington, like 1803, does that mean anything to you? And we start researching the property and find out, hey, in 1803 there was a Jack Willington who lived here. That's wonderful, you know, and that I would never, so I don't discount them, I don't dismiss them. But is it part of standard operating procedure? No, because most of them are just going to go on the whole drama queen, you know, route, and that's not serving me.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So we're getting down to the last, just the last couple of minutes here. Anything you want to add to any of the groups out there, anything that we haven't covered that you wanted to say?
You know, it occurred to me, we were talking about sharing the information and what Paranexus is doing. In New Jersey, we're forming the New Jersey Paranormal Investigative Coalition, so we're eventually going to get this launched, and it's going to be, you know, like the overall thing for New Jersey, where, like, New Jersey Ghost Hunter Society, all these other, however many hundreds of little independent groups there are, we're going to make this on a statewide level to kind of give that cohesiveness and pull us all together into a data bank to share the findings and make it a nice cross-reference tool. And that will probably be something that will then, from our state level, I would say, would work really well funneling into your more global data bank that you're pulling together.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Laura, why don't you tell everybody about your website, how they can contact you.
Oh, sure. It's the New Jersey Ghost Hunter Society, so it's the initials, NJGHS.net. And my email address, you can go to the Who's Who page, and you'll see my bio, and my email address is there. It's laurah@njghs.net. We also have the podcast, The Deadline.
Talk about that just for a minute.
Yeah, it's pretty much every Friday we upload a show, and it typically is about a half hour. Sometimes I get a little, well, as you can tell, I can talk, so sometimes the shows run a little longer, guilty, you know. But, you know, and people, we talk about the different paranormal things, any news, upcoming investigations, the monthly meetings, if we've, we do haunted trivia, so people can listen to haunted trivia and win a prize each week. And
cool, so they can access your podcast off your website, right?
Yeah, it's on the Deadline page of the NJGHS.net site. It also is available through iTunes and Podcast Alley.
Okay, very good. And I'll have a link on the archive page as well to your website for listeners.
Oh, great.
Well, Laura, it's been a pleasure having you. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us on this. And I'm sure we'll cross paths sometime down the road here, and wish you all the best of luck.
Oh, thank you. You too. And if I can make it down to Paranexus, I'm coming.
It's going to be a
hey, it was great having you tonight, and you told some wonderful, wonderful stories that I'm sure people are going to find of value. So thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. Great meeting you too, Grant.
Hey, vice versa.
All right. And for our listeners, we really appreciate you taking the time to listen as well. Next week, now we're going to have another show, same spot. Or check the website, blogtalkradio.com/spiritteam. And there's going to be a couple of changes to the format and so on and so forth. So look for the website, and really, if you go to sgradio.us, sgradio.us, it's going to be all there, as well as on the Spirit Team site, for some of the changes that we're going to do to this format. But next week, we'll announce our guest for next week on the website. We do have an interview scheduled with Bill Ryan and Carrie Cassidy of Project Camelot. Now, if you're into UFOs or anything like that, you're going to probably be familiar with Project Camelot. Very, very interesting duo there, and there is going to be some information on the site as well for that. So hang tough. That will actually be a pre-recorded show, so it's going to be archived, and we're going to announce our next week's guest in the next few days. So please join us next week. We really appreciate everybody in chat being there. Thanks for joining us. Grant, it's been a pleasure as always.
Oh, it's been wonderful, Doug, and looking forward to next week.
Sounds good. Take care, everybody. Good night.
Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.